I mean, it's true though, because we're looking to talk to people who are very similar to us, but
yeah.
Assuming they don't know any of it.
Yeah, that's so true. Hi, Quincy.
Hey there, Elsa.
Hey, I was wondering if you could just, you know, kind of introduce yourself and talk about what this podcast is going to be about.
Okay. Wow, we're just really launching into it.
Yeah, we play the theme song and here's what it is. This is our podcast. Our official title is But Why? The podcast where we ask, but why? Because that's what everyone needs to know these days.
It's the podcast where we answer the questions you never asked.
Yeah, that is our theme.
That's our slogan.
Oh,
and it's
my God.
So
okay,
true.
We're so good. That's our slogan. It's so true. Yeah, the podcast where we answer the questions you never asked. And according to Quincy's mother, the podcast for dumb nerds.
It's the only population that's going to be interested in this information.
Yeah, really specific nerds who don't know anything about the thing that they're nerdy about.
Yeah.
But yeah, so on this podcast, we plan to talk about mostly just science. We want to talk about science and the relationship between like the science and news, and how there's like a disconnect between what researchers are like actually figuring out and how it gets reported, and we're two nerdy people who just want to talk about the nerdy thing that we love.
Yeah.
But why would you listen to us?
Oh yeah, that's a good
why would
question.
You listen to us? Yeah, Quincy, what's your like background, like why would I listen to what you say?
Well, there's a good chance maybe you shouldn't. However, we both started university together at Bishop's University, which is in Quebec, mm-hmm. in Canada. I don't know who's going to be listening to this, but hopefully people outside of Canada as well.
Probably just my mom. So, like, shout out right now.
Actually, not my mom. Maybe my dad.
Yeah, not your mom.
My boss. Mom's
already said, like, no, get better.
Anyway, we both have a bachelor in science. Elsa, you finished it at Bishop's, and then I left and went to UMB, which is where I live now, New Brunswick.
I am a born and raised Ottawa girl. But yeah, you and I were in biochemistry. You graduated, so my major is biochemistry, and my minor is in English literature. So I don't know when that's going to be useful, but let's find out. Yeah, and we were just the nerdiest of study buddies. I remember, like, we would be studying, like, these, like, really just specific, like, this one type of protein and how, like, the one chemical group on it changes and then it affects your body. And we would just be making the like, most niche puns and science jokes that you've ever heard. Like, jokes that no one else, unless they were in that class on that day, would ever understand, and we would think they were hilarious.
And they were terrible. Like, granted, they were awful. They weren't really smart, funny, like, jokes.
Oh, no. It wasn't like, oh, we were so clever, we thought we should make a podcast. None of that.
No. But we just, love it.
We just love it. Yeah.
Yeah. We were both the type of people who, even when we didn't have to learn for class, we wanted to learn.
Yeah, yeah. Like, we were in a few classes where, not gonna lie, the prof had just checked out. And so, like, finishing the work was so easy. We almost could get through those classes without learning anything if we wanted to. But yeah, but you and I were just not into that. We were like, no, we gotta go figure. And we would go on these, like, long kind of Google tangents almost, where we would be like, wow, this is so cool. This is so cool. Until we realized, like, we'd spent, like, 4 hours on, like, a half hour assignment.
Yeah, totally. I don't even know, like, we would get so far into a topic and then I'd have to pull you out. I'd be like, Elsa, no, we've gone too far.
Yeah, that's for sure true. So just to briefly wrap this up, Quincy, what were your favorite topics or classes at Bishop's that we might see, or at UNB, that we might see maybe as an episode later in the podcast? Who knows? But where are you kind of like, what is your vibe of science?
Right. Well, so when I was at Bishop's, I was in biochemistry with you, Elsa, of course. But and so when I was there, I was really interested. I really liked organic chemistry. And then the immune class that we took, like the immune system, It was interesting. However, I don't know if we had the best professor for it. So that was unfortunate, but that's a topic mm-hmm. I would love to get into a bit more. And then
dude, that's hilarious. Those are my like number two and number three on my little bullet notes list is organic so chemistry, funny. Immunology. So vibing already. Continue.
I know, right? But then when I went to UMB, I actually changed my major just because biochemistry wasn't like a department there. So I'm actually, I'm a biology major. I know, it's big.
What?
I know, I never told you that.
You waited till the podcast to tell me this?
I needed the shock factor.
Yeah, you're getting a live reaction here because this is, wow, that is quite the, I guess I don't know you as well as I thought I did.
I know. Anyway, so when I got there, because I was in biology, I actually took a lot more classes on, I had a lot more environmental courses. The cool thing about UMB is that they actually have a really amazing marine sciences program because we're on the Bay of Fundy, which is like the highest tides in the world, which is really cool. So it attracts a lot of teachers who are interested in marine sciences. So we had a really, really great ecotoxicology course. That was what by far one of my favorite things I've ever taken at school, which is all about pesticides and different things we release into the environment that are destroying the environment. And then I also really just enjoyed my marine science course. So there's a lot of stuff about the ocean that I'm really interested in, and aquaculture. I took a course on that. That was amazing. And so that's kind of where my interests lie.
That is super cool. And I'm not gonna lie, I have like this deep rooted fear of the ocean in general. So I know almost nothing about it.
I have a deep rooted fear too, but I also find it fascinating. Like I don't go swimming in the ocean, but I love it.
It's terrifying. Yeah.
It's right. So yeah, terrifying.
It's going to be super cool to hear you talk about that.
Yeah. So what about you, Elsa? What are your favorite topics?
So obviously I have a biochemistry major. I stuck into biochemistry for my 4 years. And by far my favorite course is ironically not a biochemistry course. It's a biology course. I know.
Far
my favorite course at Bishop's was my evolutionary biology course.
Oh, just yeah, because you love that.
I loved it. I thought it was so cool. And like before that, even within this was, I think I took this in second semester, first year. So like even being a kid in high school interested in like this kind of topic and interested in science and interested in biology and like chemistry specifically, you don't hear a lot about evolution unless it's the controversy of evolution, right? Like you hear like, oh, the controversy of evolution, but you never actually learn the theory because high school teachers are like, this is too controversial for us to teach you. So people, you know, you just kind of gloss over it a little bit, I find.
Yeah, which I really hate. Like, why do teachers think that that's so controversial? I get like parents can be difficult to deal with, but it's just something people need to learn.
Yeah, I know. So like learning about like the actual, this word evolution has become such a big word with so many connotations and so many like, I feel emotional connotations to it, you know, where people have a feeling about evolution.
Yes.
They feel like it's for them or against them or whatnot. So just taking a course that really like went, we started with like the history and we started with like why there's so much debate and then we got into some really cool nitty gritty things that I'm for sure going to tell you in another episode. So that was by far my favorite course. But then second and third, as I said, organic chemistry and immunology. Like organic chemistry literally just means you're working with chemicals that are like carbon based, because if something's organic in a scientific context, it doesn't mean like what organic means in the grocery store. It just means like a carbon based molecule. So organic chemistry is literally, it's almost like a puzzle. It's almost like puzzles after puzzles, because you take this one molecular structure and you have to try and get it to this other molecular structure.
Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. It's kind of like a science game. It's like a science game puzzle. And we had, shout out to Alex. I'm probably going to like send him like 5 copies of this podcast. He's probably like not going to listen to them. He's going to be like, what is this? I don't have time. And we're going to be like, Alex, we love you.
Alex, we do love you. Also, special shout out to Carl.
Oh, special shout out to Carl. Oh, Carl and I. Honestly, the chemistry department, I don't know if this is true of every university, but at Bishop's at least, the chemistry department is just full of bros. I have yet to meet a chemistry prof who is not a bro. with that, our little introduction. So that's why you should at least a little bit believe us, because we know we don't know much, But we know a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, like we have 4 years of education in how to read research, how to look at something objectively and like consider all options.
Yeah, and above all else, I find too, just how to not get flustered when faced with a lot of technical terms or what, like, I don't know about you, Q, but at the in our first year whenever we were asked to do some sort of paper where we had to go and find like research papers, it was a little nerve-wracking because you'd find the research paper that talked about the thing you wanted, but then you'd only understand every third word. So it would be like
totally.
Yeah, so it'd be almost impossible to dissect what was going on, because but by the end of my degree, I'd be reading these papers, and even when I didn't understand a word or something, I understood the context of how the research paper was being written or something like that, and it just,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I also found, like, beginning of degree, I was asked to write a paper, and I could barely make the word count, because I was just like, I didn't know how to research, I didn't really know where to find the sources, and then by the end of my degree, I was like, oh my god, how do I only write this much, because it's just like once you start figuring out how to do the research on a subject, you can find anything you want.
And I find too, just in terms of like research and sources, it's like in high school when someone would ask us to write an essay and like source our all our thoughts and stuff, you'd be like, why do I have to find a source for this? This is just my idea, this is stupid, this is, you know what I mean? But now I find that even if I'm writing an Instagram post and one of my references is like that I used to draw or something is taken from a source that's not just like stock images, Google image, or like me posing and taking a photo of myself, I'm like, okay, cite that source, you know, like it's just instinctive. I'm like, oh, okay, I'm doing something. Where are my sources? I have to cite them. Like, this is so important. These sources, like I need sources and I need to cite them.
You know, science is like, the science community is like an actual community. It's one place where like people, you have to be sharing ideas. If you're not sharing them, then no one's going to move forward. It's the whole idea behind it.
Yeah, exactly. And at the start of my degree, I used to get the sense that like, if I wrote down an idea and then I found someone who said it first, I felt like I was taking away. I was like, oh, I thought of this, but now I have to cite as if it's, and it's like, no. That is excellent. You have an idea and you find someone else who thought it too. You go like, look, this peer-reviewed paper also thought this, so it's a great idea to put into a paper. You know what I mean? Like,
yes, absolutely.
Yeah, this idea that like quote-unquote originality in science doesn't mean you're the first one to say something. It means you're taking what everyone else said and you're putting it into a context that you're like, hey, let's think about it this way, or hey, like this might be a certain trend that like we'll see. And actually, on that note, speaking of trends and stuff, because scientific papers and just like a lot of research is so hard to get into, just because there are so many terms and like jargons, I was wondering, Quincy, can we go over a few of those terms?
Why, yes, Elsa, I think we can.
Wow, well, how convenient.
It just so happens that I have a list right in front of me.
Oh my god, do share, please.
Okay, so I think the main one that people, it's always talked about in the media, and everyone seems to get it wrong, is the word theory.
Oh, yes, hit me with this. Hit me with the true definition of theory, because that is one that it's weird because it has a definition in language, and then it has a scientific definition. And those two things are often confused.
So different. And that is actually, before we go into it, is like the most important distinction, is that there is a scientific definition and there is like a real world, like English definition. And they're totally different. And you have to understand the differences between them.
I imagine you have a definition in front of you too. I have a definition of theory from the National Academy of Sciences. Would you like me, could I read this to you?
Yes, please.
The National Academy of Sciences says, some scientific explanations are so well established that no new evidence is likely to alter them. So the explanation becomes a scientific theory. In everyday language, a theory means a hunch or speculation, not so in science. In science, the word theory refers to a comprehensive explanation of an important feature of nature supported by facts gathered over time. So theories also allow scientists to make predictions based on this like huge well of knowledge. But essentially what this definition is saying is that a theory is not just something that like someone comes up with. A topic only becomes a scientific theory if there is a well of knowledge so big or so established that scientists cannot conceivably think of evidence that will come in and refute the entire theory.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, the most important part of that explanation is that, like, what we're looking at has been substantiated through repeated experiments and testing.
And I think that the term theory often gets conflated with the term hypothesis,
mm-hmm.
Which
yes.
is different. Yeah. Q, do you have could you give us a wee bit of a description of hypothesis?
Well, I think I want to say, like, what most people think a hypothesis is an educated guess. And that's mm-hmm. where we get these lines drawn. It's like someone has just looked at something and, like, based off of a couple things that they've got in their mind, like, they've guessed what's going to happen. But that's mm-hmm. not really how scientists use it at all.
Yeah, no, a hypothesis is not just an educated guess. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a proposed explanation for something that can actually be tested. So they've looked at something, they've observed it long enough, and they're like, listen, I've looked at this. This is a potential way that this could happen. Now I'm going to set up a test that can either, like, show that the evidence leans towards it, or I'm trying not to use the word proved because
oh, yeah, I know yeah, that's not the right word. No.
Yes, I guess substantiated yeah. is the word that you have to use in this situation. It's like, whatever you've seen and you've observed, you can now put into a test to see if you can recreate it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so you do bring up a good point, because we don't want to use words like proved or like or anything that has a certainty or finality to it. And that is something that often gets kind of exploited in national debates on scientific topics, where scientists, if a scientist says 100% or proved, that is not a good scientist. That is not a good, like, study. That is not a good conclusion, because in science, it is, you know that you know nothing. Like, in science, we go in saying we have made these predictions, or we have written down these observations, but they are based on observations. So we've taken things that we've watched the world, we wrote down what we saw, and we made predictions based on that, right? So, but we are often wrong. And what science really acknowledges again and again is that we are often wrong. We were like that. We used to think mercury would cure everything, right? And it was poisonous. Like, we have to have a venue for which to improve research, or for
absolutely,
which to improve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost more about asking questions than finding answers.
Yeah, exactly. So even when we have a very substantiated paper, or if we have a hypothesis, we test it and our data seems to support our hypothesis, you phrase it like that, like, our data supports our hypothesis, or this
yes.
got this. Yeah, exactly. Because it's not, even if your experiment is quote unquote successful, like, you've made a hypothesis and you did it and it did exactly what you thought it was going to do, that doesn't mean you've proved something. That means that we observe that this trend or this pattern is likely to repeat itself, because we've done experiments and the pattern seems consistent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Elsa, knowing
yes,
all that, when is your support significant? When is your finding significant?
Oh, my Lord. Yeah, so significant is a very important word in studies, because what you have is you have, at the end of the day, you have data that is either statistically significant or not. And so in order for,
or
you about that data because it is trash. No, I'm kidding. Statistical significance is this determination between two or more variables that is caused by something other than chance. So that means I have these, my two variables, which we'll get into independent and dependent variables in a second, but I have, let's say, once I have this proposed relationship between two things, I need to test if that relationship actually exists as I have observed it, or if, yes, my line goes down, but it turns out that the fire alarm was going off at the same time and my mom was really annoyed about the fire alarm sound, right? Like, I have to see if this relationship is caused by what I think it's caused by, or at very least is influenced by the thing that I am testing, or if this is actually just, it happens to look like it has a relationship, but in reality, this is not significant. This is not statistically significant, and this relationship just looks like a pattern but is not actually caused by or not related to the change in my independent variable.
Yeah, absolutely. Now that you're talking about variables, how about you give the definition of the independent variables, and then I'm going to give you my really, really wonderful example of variables that I know you're going to love.
Ooh, I'm so excited. Okay, yeah, so I mentioned once or twice a dependent and independent variables, and that is, if you picture a graph, that is your x and y axis, basically. So first we have the independent variable. The independent variable is the factor that you purposefully change or control in order to see what effect it has. So the independent variable is the one that I am in control of it. So I am in control of the number of times I ask my mom the same question, right? I can ask her 2 times, I can ask her 3 times, but it is me who chooses that number. And that will not change while my dependent variable changes. So as my mother's mood like gets better or worse, right? The number of times I ask the question is not affected by her mood. It's affected by how many times I run the trial. So that's your independent variable. Mm-hmm. Then you have your dependent variable, your independent variable goes on your x-axis. Then you have your dependent variable that goes on your y-axis, and that the dependent variable responds to the change in the independent variable. So as my independent variable, the number of times I ask questions, goes up, my dependent variable, her mood, supposedly goes down.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so I'm gonna run a little study on you right now, Elsa.
Oh my god, I love it.
Information. So we want to look at how different things annoy Elsa and which gets the greatest response.
Oh my god,
that is our study. So the independent variable, as we've discussed, would be your choice of annoyance, and the dependent variable would be how annoyed Elsa got. So Elsa, I have prepared 2 sentences to annoy you.
Are you ready? Yes. I'm so ready.
Okay. Number one, Carl, our lab tech, is one of the worst humans I've ever met.
Oh my god! I know that you set this up for a study, but how dare you speak such falsities? And I also understand that this is a reference that is so niche that only our class from Bishop will ever understand it. But how dare you suggest?
I know.
Okay. The sweetest human being on the planet.
So how angry would you say you are by that?
On a scale of like 1 to 10, like at least an 8. This is Carl's honor here. Yeah. And we can't like.
It's true. You got to stick up for Carl for sure.
So I would say I'm in an 8 there.
Okay. So my second phrase is evolution is a made up concept by scientists to try and get rid of religion.
Oh, you fucker. Oh my God. You have literally taken everything I loved, and you have just set it on fire. You've just thrown it away. Everything that led up to this moment, you've just gone like, let's all throw it in the trash. Oh Lord. Also,
this is how I always used to get you riled up. You need to give me a scale 1 to 10. How did that second sentence make you feel?
I must admit, I love Carl, and he is a fantastic human being. But that the second one was 10 out of 10, just for the sheer amount of research and people who got dismissed by the fact that, yes, I'm going to say 10 out of 10.
10 out of 10 on that one? All right. I think that's totally fair. So what we learned from this study is that if you really, really want to annoy Elsa, you just have to talk about how evolution is made up.
Yeah, that is honestly, that's so true. So speaking of relationships, Quincy, and how ours is now strained thanks to this.
It was worth it.
Within science, when you're talking about, of course, it was. In science, when you're talking about two different variables and the relationship between them, there are these two concepts that often get conflated together, which is correlation and causation. So we're doing the study, and you notice that there is a trend. So when our independent variable increases, our dependent variable also increases. That seems to be a trend of positive correlation. So if we picture our graph, and yes, I'm using a lot of visuals on a purely auditory format, but if you picture a graph with just a straight line, like going up diagonally, that we could say that if that is describing the relationship between two variables, we can see that there is a correlation between them. A correlation means there is a relationship or pattern between the values of two variables. So a scatter plot could display these, and usually if you have a scatter plot of variables, you'll use like a line of best fit to try to describe that relationship. But the point is, if there is a perceived relationship between two variables, we call that a correlation. That could be a positive or a negative correlation, but there's something there. What that often gets conflated with is causation, So we often, it's kind of confusing because often in science, if you see a relationship between two variables, you might immediately think like, oh, X causes Y, or like X goes up, therefore Y goes up. That's a relationship, but X goes up, therefore Y will always go up because X causes Y to go up. That is causation, and that is not the same thing. That's something too, that when you're reading a study or you're reading something like that, that's often confusing because when it gets re-reported as, it's often, a correlation is often re-reported as a causation. So it's often said that like,
take that word.
Yeah. Right. It loves to, it makes sense because it's something that humans just in general, like, we like to know why. Right.
Yeah. Absolutely.
If you study those official in philosophy, those like, logic fallacies or like fallacies and errors in logic and everything like that, there's one that's almost the same as correlation versus causation. I can't remember exactly what it is now, but we see this again and again where humans like to see patterns even when there isn't necessarily a pattern. So in science, we're very, very clear to say like, yes, this is a perceived relationship, but it doesn't mean that this relationship is caused by the thing that we are observing.
Yeah. And that also kind of like leads to using the word like assumption, like we assume something. Mm-hmm. Because we can use it for very specific situations. Like we can assume that the data has the requirements to like use a certain mathematical model or something to help like us mm-hmm. predict an outcome. But we can't just mm-hmm. assume that outcome. We can't just say like, no, this is going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. And that does kind of bring us to just this idea of certainty versus uncertainty or confidence you can have in your data. First, you get your data. And then you graph your data, and then you draw like a line to try and predict your data. And then what you have to do is you have to do a bunch of statistical analysis and stuff like that to determine like how strong is this relationship and how much confidence can we have in this relationship. So for that, we look at this concept called uncertainty. I'm kind of monologuing here, but if I can keep going.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You go for it.
Certainty is a parameter associated with the result of a measurement that characterizes the dispersion of the value that could reasonably be attributed to the measure. So what the heck does that mean? It means like whenever I take a measurement, so that could be if I'm measuring the length of my desk with a ruler, if I'm like whatever measurement I'm taking, if I'm measuring the annoyance of someone, there is a certain level of uncertainty within that measurement that just exists. So it's easiest to explain this when talking about like measuring something with a ruler, just because it's very visual, it's very easy to understand, but this will apply to lots of things. So if I have a ruler and I'm measuring something, my ruler is precise up to millimeters, right?
Yeah.
But the thing that I'm measuring probably is the length of a fraction of a millimeter. So when you're measuring something, you don't know what that fraction of a millimeter is, right? You're uncertain. Your material that you're using to measure does not tell you, and you can eyeball it and you can guess, but your guess is going to be just that. It's going to be a guess because your eyes are not so precise that they can measure a fraction of a millimeter by just looking at it.
Yeah, exactly. And so in this situation, your confidence like is a lot less because you're so unsure, but then you start to get more precise measuring tools. So you graduate from like a ruler to some sort of like laser calculator kind of thing that can measure the distance the laser is, you know, being dispersed or something, you know, just totally made up. But
yeah, so you can do that. You can improve your tools and you can minimize your uncertainty. But with each measurement, you have to record that level of uncertainty. So if I'm measuring with a ruler, I'd say, okay, my measurement is 2 centimeters, 3 millimeters, with an uncertainty of plus or minus like a millimeter, because I am not sure if it's actually 2 centimeters, 3 millimeters and a half, or if it's 2 centimeters and 2 millimeters 0.8, right? Like I don't know what fraction of that last millimeter my ruler doesn't tell me. So that is my uncertainty. So when I'm using a ruler, my uncertainty would be like a millimeter either way. Mm-hmm. Uncertainty is actually something that you want to see in a paper because you want to see the scientist be like, I acknowledge that my answer could be from here to here. It could be anything within that value and I don't know, right? But you want to know what those parameters are because no one is just going to make an observation that is 100% exactly as it was in the real world. You know what I mean? There's going to be sources of error. And here, so error is used to mean the difference between a measured value and the true value of the measurement. So if I'm looking in my graduated cylinder, I'm measuring millimeters,
I'm sorry, not millimeters, milliliters, but measuring milliliters, you know, if I look from the top of my test tube and I look from the bottom of my test tube, it's going to look like it's at a different height, right? Like so there are just all these things that like you can minimize how you look at your test tube to get the exact volume of water, but you just have to acknowledge that every time you make a measurement, there will be factors that will influence how you observe that measurement.
Yeah, it's also mm-hmm. not necessarily that you didn't find the right answer. Like, maybe you did, but it's what we're trying to do is make sure that we have a range of values that will definitely contain the right answer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so uncertainty, as you said, is one of the key words in the definition. Is uncertainty, as used here, means the range of possible values within which the true value of the measurement lies. So if I go back to my ruler, if I'm measuring something and I just put the measurement that I think I see and then I do all my calculations, sometimes those calculations can get like that. If I'm 1 millimeter off in my calculations and I start multiplying my values and I start dividing, I start like squaring them, you know what I mean? That error becomes bigger and bigger and bigger because I'm using it in calculations. But if I do all my calculations with my uncertainty, so if I say, okay, my measurement is 2 centimeters plus or minus 2 millimeters, and then I do all my calculations and I also do my calculations to my uncertainty, at the end, I come up with whatever, like it's physics, so you start with like millimeters and you go to like velocity somehow. You're like, ah, yes, meters per second. And you're like, how did we get there? I don't know.
Me, so, every time so I tried to do physics.
Yeah, every time I tried to do physics, like, okay.
I got there somehow.
Yeah, in chemistry, your units are great. They're just like, you have milliliters and like moles or whatever, and then you have milliliters per mole. You're like, great, that is what it is. In physics, they just change the letter all the time.
All the time.
Oh, anyways. All the time. Anyways, if I keep track of my uncertainties, by the time I get my end result value, so when I get my velocity at the end and I say, okay, 25 like kilometers per second, that'd be so crazy fast, but whatever. And I have my plus or minus 5 kilometers per second. I know that within that 25 kilometers, so that could mean the true answer is 20 kilometers or it could mean the true answer is 30 kilometers. I don't know which one the true answer is, but I know within this range, the true answer is in there.
And that is so much information. Like, even if it's within a, you know, a 5 kilometer range, like, yeah, that might be quite a range, but it's so like, you know, the truth is within there.
Yeah. And so that's when statistical significance becomes really important, because that's when, okay, if I look at my pattern and I take into account my uncertainty, you know, like that is when I can determine whether or not these results have value, have statistical significance.
Which I think brings us to, I have, and I'm sure you have too, this week found a few articles mm-hmm. that discuss some scientific topics that are relevant to today and that are not necessarily peer-reviewed and not necessarily done in the most, or at least not necessarily reported in the most efficient manner. So I thought it would be a cool thing today if like we went through some news headlines and just kind of analyzed it with a scientific lens and just said, okay, this is how this is being reported, but let's look at what actually went down in this research or in this study.
Yes, let's do it. Do you want to start, Elsa?
Sure. I actually have a very topical article today. I have an article on the Pfizer or whatever, the vaccine for COVID made by the Pfizer. How do we pronounce that company?
I thought it was Pfizer.
Is it Pfizer?
I think it's Pfizer.
That makes a lot of sense, but that is a silly way
to spell that.
So just as kind of a funny note, so we made it kind of our mission this week to go and look for articles that were purposefully like not reporting personally misleading, so that we could. And when I started researching like just scientific news, I kept on coming up, because I have spent 4 years in a biochemistry degree and like Google learns from your results, right? Mm-hmm. Like at first I just typed in news articles and every single thing that came up was a peer-reviewed journal.
Oh my god, same.
Right? And I was like, this is great. This is fantastic. But I realized that my search algorithm is giving me reliable news sources because I am very steeped in this field. That is not necessarily the same experience for everyone else. So I like
I popped on a VPN, I went into a new tab, I like signed on as a guest to Google, and then I retyped my answers, and the first thing that came up was Fox News, and I was like, yeah.
Yep, we found our niche.
VPN. I like literally put my VPN in the States, and I just typed in my same question, and the results were very different, and I was like, oh,
that
okay.
is amazing.
Yeah, right.
Looking so for I've unreliable been... news? Check out Fox.
Right? It was so funny. I was like, lol. So yeah, so just side note, gentle viewer, just a listener. If when you are researching anything, when you're Googling anything, keep in mind that Google has an algorithm that remembers the things you've Googled in the past. So like if you're constantly looking at peer-reviewed articles, it will give you more peer-reviewed articles. And if you get stuck in a cycle of unreliable news, you will just keep being fed unreliable news.
Yes, absolutely. That is very important to note.
Mm-hmm. So that was just my little like PSA there. Thank you. So my first article was before I put on my VPN. So it's actually pretty well written. The article itself is very well written. If you read it all the way through to the end, you got a very comprehensive view. But it was talking about the Pfizer vaccine in a realistic way that is not talked about in a lot of other articles that I've seen. So I thought it would still be interesting to just talk about this vaccine in general and how everything has been reported on this vaccine. Right, so first, very important, the author of my article is Tina Hesman-Say. I don't know how to pronounce her name, but the important part about this is she is a senior staff writer and reports on molecular biology. She has a PhD in molecular genetics from Washington University and a master's degree in scientific journalism from Boston.
It sounds like she should know what's up.
That's what I mean. Yeah, yeah. So this article very much was very good in that it did know a lot of what's up, but it was very good at pointing out some things that other articles were not good. So I thought it would be a good way to like, we'll start with a good article and then I'll show you like a crappy article, but still be relevant. Don't worry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was just one important thing is that when you're looking at an article, look at who wrote it, because if the person who wrote it doesn't have a background in science, even if they're a great journalist, they'll probably just not be as well versed in scientific language. So they'll probably make those mistakes of saying certainty or say, you know what I mean? Just things that wouldn't come up normally.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just some things that have been reported. Yeah, so just some things that have been reported about this vaccine is that everyone keeps saying it's 95% effective, 95% effective, 95% effective. And that's reported almost everywhere. That's a headline, like 95% effective vaccine. And what this article suggested a little bit and what we need to take into account is that it is 95% effective based on one, lab data, which is very different than field data. So, yes. And two, that, and this article pointed this out, which was very good, but these results shared in the new release have yet to be peer reviewed. So it is 95% effective within a controlled environment of the lab. And because these results are so new, no one has peer reviewed their method yet.
Yeah.
So that is something that hasn't really been reported. Right? Mm-hmm. It's reported, yeah, it's 95, 95, 95, but they don't say like, oh, but it's 95 without all of these things. So
yeah, it's like, it's 95, lab but take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, exactly. It's not, but it will not be 95 when it gets released, because 95% effective means if everyone gets the vaccine, if everyone gets it, 95% of the people who get it will be protected, because a vaccine is not 100% effective, but not everyone will get the vaccine. Right? No. The other thing to note is this vaccine requires two doses a certain time period apart. So there are going to be a lot of people who get the first dose and don't get the second dose. And if you don't get the second dose, that is not an effective vaccine, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The third thing to keep into account is that this study was done on the vaccine is they vaccinated volunteers, and then the volunteers went and lived their life, and they kept track of the volunteers. And because COVID is spiking so high, you know, they presume that everyone got a little bit exposed in their life and stuff like that. But the type of person who's going to volunteer for a vaccine for COVID-19 is the type of person who is going to be more aware of the regulations and probably more likely to follow stay-at-home orders or to follow what the scientists recommend, right?
Yeah, so, it is really important to note where your subjects come from, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so this is a volunteer-based study, right? And so when you have someone who's going to volunteer for this, for a subject, they are going to be more involved with that subject, with listening to regulations, with being aware of what the regulations are, than your average Joe from the street.
Yeah. Like, just an example of how serious it is to, like, keep track of your subjects. I did a study in my ecotoxicology course on the great pond snail. And we had a history of these pond snails. Like, we knew where they came from in the wild and when they were brought into, like, the test facility and how many generations had been born since that initial wild group. Like, it is really important to know the history, because that could affect your results.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's important to know the kind of context of the things that you are studying. Yeah.
Yeah.
And just the final, like, little thing I want to say about this, just this Pfizer releasing this vaccine that didn't really get reported. And again, all of this was in a very good article. So this article touched on a lot of these issues, saying, like, this and this. But again, it only touched on it, like, if you read the whole article. And most people are just getting titles and they're getting the, like, 2 second. But the last thing about this vaccine study was, normally, and then this is a quote, normally it may take months to tally the cases needed to make a final efficiency determination. But infection rates in the United States have been so high that coronavirus cases quickly racked up in the trial, speeding up the timeline for analyzing the final results. So that's just saying that usually when we conduct a study like this on a disease and a vaccine and how efficient the vaccine is, it takes months of observation. But this, because COVID is so prevalent in the United States, because the spikes are so high, this sped up the timeline significantly. So now I'm saying all of this not to be like, yo, this vaccine is gonna suck. This is no. A vaccine is great news. I am so on board with this. I think, like, this is great. This is good study. This is, like, this is good stuff. This is good news. But the number 95% being so prevalent in the news is a little bit dangerous, because that people take that number and they don't take into account any of these other factors, right?
And part of the danger in that situation especially is, like, if you took from that it's 95% effective, when it does get released, whenever that is, people are going to be super flippant about the rules that we now have in place. Like, they're like, oh no, I got the vaccine, so that means I'm immune and I can go and do whatever I want. Well, yeah. No, yeah, you can't, exactly. Because we don't actually have any idea how it's going to work on a large scale level
in the real world, where there are 1,000 other variables, some of which are just going to be some people who don't get the vaccine, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And, like, you know, and it's going to be a tough time to get it pushed out into the whole population for everyone to be available to do it. And so, you know, what if you take it into a senior's home or something like that? And you're like, no, I had the vaccine. Like, I'm good.
Yeah. No. Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't
still could
vaccine.
Be endangering.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a radioactive spider and suddenly you're Spider-Man. You know what I mean? You're not going to be able to throw yourself into danger and be like, ah, but I have the vaccine. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And then what often happens with these kind of things is, you know, the people take 95% effective, and then if it's not 95% effective in the field, in real life, people are going to turn around and be like, scientists are liars. See, we always knew this. Scientists are liars. Look, they lied about this number. And it's like, no, your misunderstanding of how these facts are being reported does not mean that the scientists are lying to you.
Yeah. Also, 5% is actually quite a large percentage when you think about how many people in the world need to get that vaccine.
It is something like that. You take that percentage without the context of how many people that actually means and the actual numbers that is associated with, right? And it sounds like not that bad. Quincy, do you want to tell me about a news article that you have found that is just not good?
Okay, so I had the same problem as you, Elsa. When I started researching, the only things that were coming up were really good journals and, like, also just magazines, like science-based magazines written by people who are in scientific fields, like that kind of stuff. So instead of doing what you did, I actually just went to a website that I know is known for having bad, like, badly reported news.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the Daily Mail.
Oh my God, fantastic.
Yeah. And just went started like going through. They have like a section just for science articles, and I just went to that and started scrolling. And so, okay, I'm gonna read you the title. I did not copy down the author's name because they had no qualifications worth mentioning.
Okay, yeah.
So, some Amazon rainforest regions are more resistant to climate change than previously thought and could actually benefit from warmer temperatures, study finds.
Oh, no.
This is the title.
Oh my God. Just that title. May I just make an initial observation? Just that title is building up to be climate change denying. You know what I mean? Like 100%. Just the way that's phrased. Continue. I am hooked. Hook, line. You got me hook, line, and sinker.
And it's interesting. As you start to read this article, of course I can't read the whole thing to you now, but as you start to read it, you do see they kind of bring it back to the main message of the study, sort of. They have a lot of things wrong about it, but they don't make it straight up like, oh, climate change will be good for the rainforest. Like, no. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to read you their main points. Like, the way this article was structured was they gave like 5 main points and then they elaborated. Mm-hmm. So the first one, researchers studies how changes in soil and air moisture affect photosynthesis. So that was kind of like the methods. Mm-hmm. It had been thought that.
Side note, can we just say that that title of that research paper is not making extravagant claims about climate change as a whole on the Earth. It's saying we're studying the effects of like on this soil, the effects of these things changing. So let's just like just right away, this is not a study on climate change in an abstract concept.
No, God, no.
Okay, continue.
It had been thought that water stress would have a broadly negative impact. This in turn would slow carbon uptake by the Amazon and increase warming. However, in wetter areas, dry air causes plants to grow more efficient leaves. The team warned, though, that excessive warming would also harm these areas. Okay. So, okay.
Yeah.
This is what I got into. So that phrase, however, in wetter areas, dry air causes plants to grow more efficient leaves. Mm-hmm. That's not what they were saying. So this article is something else, I tell you.
Lord.
Basically, what I got from the study is that we are measuring the effects of air dryness properly. So all they were trying to say is, listen, our current model for examining what climate change could possibly do to the rainforest it's not dynamic enough. There's not enough information on the vegetation, basically, because there is such rich vegetation in the rainforest that, yes, maybe one type of leaf is dying off, but when that happens, another one is going to kind of fill in the spot and so they're just like, we need to go forward. Like, when we're doing our research on how climate change will affect the rainforest, we need a more dynamic model that can account for these changes in vegetation. What they did find, so the way they conducted the research was basically they used 9 years of data using like satellite information and like vegetation, and they checked what happened from like the wet seasons to the dry seasons and years that were more dry than others. And like they did find in this research that there was actually more photosynthesis occurring during the drier wet seasons. But their reasoning for this, and they have good reasoning, and it is based on their vegetation, is that when it gets really dry, the top layer of the canopy, so the rainforest is such like a dense canopy, mm-hmm. the top leaves die off because they do get too dry. But what happens is it actually lets more light down into the rest of the canopy. And so this extra light is making the leaves below it grow really quickly, and they're newer leaves, they're less old like the ones at the top, so they're actually producing more, like they're doing more photosynthesis because they're newer and fresher plants. And so it's compensating for the fact that this top layer has been destroyed. And then they also say, like, when it's a little bit drier, there's also less fungi, which, you know, cover the leaves. But they're saying nothing about what happens when there's less fungi in the rainforest. They're not showing what the effects of losing certain types of, you know, species that are found in this rainforest will do to the whole structure of the ecosystem. They're just simply saying that there are technically more photosynthesis and more leaves occurring than when there was a top canopy.
Oh, that is so cool. And that relates to what we were saying earlier about like the uncertainty, how it's important to have uncertainty and how it's important correlation versus causation, kind of these other variables. So like, that's very important to note that they are studying this one type of soil in this one situation, but an entire ecosystem has so many more variables that are so much more complex and related to each other. And if one thing changes at the bottom, it's going to affect the creatures who are at the top. And like that is such
exactly.
a... Yeah, that is such a complex thing that you cannot just take this small study on this one area and say this is going to apply to the entire ecosystem and this, here's how climate change is going to work out. You know?
Like, no. They're basically saying that, listen, there just needs to be more uncertainty than we have been allowing for on our global, like our climate change research on the rainforest. We just need to put a little extra uncertainty in there. And actually, like, yeah, it's potentially the rainforest has a bit more resilience than we originally gave it credit for. And that's great. But it doesn't have enough resilience to climate change that if it keeps going the direction we're going in, that these plants will still be able to survive.
Yeah, yeah, we'll get into this at the evolution episode and stuff like that. But yeah, like the creatures and plants will adapt to changing environments. That's essentially the only definition of evolution, is they adapt over time. Plants are so fast. Yeah, because what happens is these changes can only come generationally. So if you're a plant, you can basically reproduce yourself all the time. Plants can perform asexual and sexual reproduction. So like plants are there, they can have, you can have three generations of plants alive at the same time, right? But
yeah,
so they adapt pretty fast because they can have a lot of offspring in a short amount of time. But like humans or elephants who have like whatever gestational periods of like 3 years and the elephants themselves look like changes in how humans or elephants or like those bigger organisms adapt to climate change and stuff like that is going to be slower because we can't get as many generations out. Like we can't get that I have a baby and then my baby has a baby and then my baby has a baby, right? As quickly exactly. as plants can. Yeah. So like these changes in ecosystems and in rainforests and that kind of thing, those changes will come faster just because plants can have babies whenever the fuck they want.
Mm-hmm. And so this is the other really important thing about this study that was never mentioned in the article, is that although rates of photosynthesis increase, stomatal and ecosystem conduction reduces. So there's this stress basically on the plants that is still there and it is increasing, but it's not enough stress to stop the photosynthesis. They don't have to change their priority of energy enough yet. But it's still not good. It's not good for it. There's just more photosynthesis occurring.
Oh, that's super cool.
Yeah.
I mean, it's bad, but it's like, bad. That's super interesting.
Yeah. It's all just based on like this entire research study was just like, listen, the models that are currently representing the Amazon's vulnerability to dryness just appear to be overestimated. And that's all we want to say. And this is the research we use to state that. But of course, this article was like, nope, guess what? Climate change might actually be okay for a little bit.
Yeah, which is just, so ridiculous. It's so, like, if I may bring up the second article, and I'll do it pretty fast because it's there's a lot of the same kind of issues in it, but it has, like yours, a very inflammatory title, and then you read the whole article, which not everyone is going to do. Most people are just going to read the title, right? And the entire article is basically backpedaling from the title. But the title...
Oh my God.
Okay, listen to this. The title of this is, and this was the VPN, like Fox News bull, like this article that I found, right? This is, should researchers shelve plans to deliberately infect people with coronavirus?
Oh my God.
Right? You read that and you're like, what the hell? Like, who is planning to deliberately infect people? And then the first, I have a quote here. It's maybe the first sentence or maybe the second paragraph or whatever, but it's a quote in the first two paragraphs. It says, in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, tens of thousands of young people volunteered to offer to risk their health by letting scientists intentionally infect them with the pandemic coronavirus, hoping to speed the hunt for a vaccine or treatment. And so one, sources, please. Tens of thousands of these, like, just anonymous youths of the country, tens of thousands of them have volunteered for scientists, just just scientists, not a particular scientist, not a particular, just scientists to the intentionally scientist. Infect them with the yeah. with the virus, like to start, like so inflammatory.
I feel like someone just like went through TikTok and was like, "Wow, there's a lot of kids on here saying they'd take the coronavirus."
Yeah, like, oh, these guys are making memes about like drinking bleach. Like that must be like what the hell? Okay, so for starters, just that the and that was the first paragraph. It's just so inflammatory and no sources. No sources within, and just so we note the difference here, this article is written by Warren Cornwall, who is just a freelance journalist in Washington State with no background in science.
Wonderful.
And I'm not saying if you don't have a background in science, you can't write about scientific facts. I'm not saying that at all, but like, just if you're reading an article who's written by someone who doesn't have a background in science, keep these things in mind, because you're probably going to have to edit the article yourself for what this is said versus what it actually means.
Yeah, you should always go into reading an article like you're going to be their peer reviewer.
Yeah, exactly. And so when they say something that shocks you, look to see if there's a source at the end of that sentence.
Yes.
If they say something shocking and there is not a source, probably it's not as shocking as it sounds. Because yeah, so you read this article and you're like, holy cow, scientists are trying to kill all the young people in the world, this is horrible, let's stop this, right? But then you start reading it, and basically these two papers have written articles saying this might be an option when the coronavirus becomes when we understand it a little more, it might be an option that and they do what's called a challenge trial, which is you get a bunch of people who will be at low risk for coronavirus. So and they'll probably be young, they'll probably be healthy with no existing conditions. And when you read this article, there is like a whole paragraph about the variables that will have to be controlled just in order to volunteer for the hypothetical study that might take place, right?
Right.
And so they say, and so what they do is they take these people who are young, who have no history of illness, who have blah, 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 blah. They presume will be able to survive the virus with little to no bad effects, right? And then they inject them with the smallest dose of the virus that they can inject them with. So they first, a study has to be done to see how small of a dose of the virus you can inject someone with for it to still, like, your body to still beat it, but to be able to beat it efficiently. So first, a study has to be done on how small this dose can be. And then you get your volunteers who you vet very significantly. And then you inject them with this smallest dose. And what this does is that you keep them in a controlled environment, and their body defeats the virus in a controlled environment with access to medical care, with access to help and stuff like that. And then, so when your body defeats a virus, quote unquote, it's your body learns how to develop antibodies that will attach itself to this particular virus and essentially eat it, right? And so what a vaccine is a vaccine is you dose someone with a dead version of the virus, and that teaches your body how to develop antibodies to kill the virus, so that when a live version of the virus comes in your body, you can kill it, right?
Yeah, it's like artificial intelligence, you know?
Yeah, basically, it's like
it learns, and then it's like, okay, and now I will produce this function every time I come in contact with it.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so in this study, you inject them with the smallest dose possible of live virus, they develop antibodies, and then you use those antibodies they develop to develop a vaccine. What this essentially does is it speeds up your ability to develop a vaccine, right? Because the body is the best chemical, like your body is really good at performing scientific experiments on a biochemical level, right?
Oh my gosh, yes. Yeah.
It's so good. It's like the best, the petri dish, or it's not petri dish, but it's like the best. So you let the body do most of the work, and then it's like you get a leg up on helping us. So anyway, so there were two articles that released that saying that maybe this might be a good idea to consider doing a challenge trial in the future. And, you know, and when you read the two articles, you're like, you know what, this is an important thing to take into account, you know, and even both articles said, if a vaccine gets released in the meantime, this option will probably take a back seat, and the vaccine will take priority, right? So the research papers themselves say, like, this might be an option, if we get a better option, we'll do that first, right?
Right.
And so you read it, and you're like, this is totally reasonable. One of the quotes by one of these scientists at Harvard is, this woman says, "I think I would feel more comfortable waiting a bit to see how things develop and whether the risk could be minimized further," when she's discussing whether or not a challenge trial should be done. Literally, all these scientists have done, these quote-unquote scientists who want thousands of young people, is they've released papers being like, hey, guys, this might be an option if we can figure out how to do it safely.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and then the article title is just like, should scientists, like, affect thousands of young people? And you're like, oh, my God, that's just so much not what they said.
You are going to get the helicopter parents going wild.
Yeah, right? Like, that's, it's just so inflammatory. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know how to read scientific articles, scientific reporting, yeah, if you don't know how to read that, and if you don't know how to, like, self-edit or, like review it, it's, you're just gonna get scared. Because that's a scary title.
It's not even that maybe they wouldn't understand that type of article if they went and actually read it, but it's the fact that you're presented this first source, and that's as far as most people go.
Yeah, because and honestly, I respect that. Like, if I am reading a journal article, I do not want to have to read this article and then go read their sources just to make sure they're telling me the truth. Like, that
exactly. Like, people want to believe that the information that the media is giving them is completely based on fact.
Yeah, exactly. And it, like, in an ideal world, we should be able to do that.
Oh yeah.
It's just for sure.
Yeah.
It's just the kind of like national/global debate when it comes to scientific topics has just been so skewed towards not actually understanding where the scientists are coming from and what the language they use means, and what, like, it's just so skewed that, like, it is almost like two people are speaking different languages, and then they're getting upset when they misunderstand each other, you know? Like,
well, and that's part of the problem too, is like, different people are good at different things, right? Like, someone who writes for a news outlet is there because they have an interest in literature. They have an interest. They took, you know, school to learn how to write convincingly and emotionally so that people get attached to what they write. But then on the other hand, you get people who all they do are do science. They're very analytical, but they don't write in a way that is really appealing to a viewer. And so
that's where the disconnect happens
when someone who is good at writing doesn't know how to understand the analytical writing of a scientist.
Because we want so much to just have that headline that tells us what it's about, you know? Like, we want to say, like, read the headline, here's what it is. And you want a catchy headline if you're a writer. You want to write something that's going to draw people in.
Yeah. Also, what I'm taking from this is that you have a major in science and a minor in literature. And now I think maybe you need to just go and write articles that make people like science more.
You know what? I think that might be... That might be my destiny, honestly.
It might be.
With this podcast, first I'm going to talk at people about science.
And then I'm going
to write about science.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I'm going to write at people. I'm going to answer all of the questions that they never asked.
Yeah. Okay, I feel like this podcast has gone on quite a while. So, Elsa, what is your number one takeaway from what we've discussed today?
Oh, man. Okay, so my number one takeaway is definitely that the title, especially the title of a news article, is something like that, is usually much more inflammatory than the actual article itself. So that when you're looking at something that has come up with quote unquote conclusive findings or whatnot, you have to look at how sure they are of what they're looking at, of whether this was peer reviewed, and just like take everything that sounds surprising is probably not entirely true. Like, everything is more complicated than just that one sentence clickbait article news title.
Yeah. I think my key takeaway from this podcast is just be a critical thinker. Think for yourself. If you are reading an article and you're like, I don't know if that quite makes sense to me, don't just believe it. You need to go out, find the research that could support it or show that they're wrong, and really take into consideration all the factors, everything that we've told you about today, all of the different scientific language. To truly understand a topic, you need to do the work, do the research, make sure you understand everything that they've discussed, and then you can finally say that you understand a topic.
That is a much better takeaway than mine. that is an excellent thing going forward. But yeah, so gentle viewers.
Gentle viewers.
And for yourself.
Are we going to call our listeners gentle viewers?
Yes, we are. I'm not going to lie. It's a Buffy reference from one episode in the seventh season by a character who's not the main character, but I'm sticking with it.
All right. Goodbye, gentle viewers.
This has been But Why, a podcast with Elsa and Quincy, where we answer the questions that you never asked and didn't want to know.
Talk to you later.